Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. USU professor of German Claudia Schwabe recently presented an Aggie Talks event called What Disney Didn't Tell You, a tour of the original Grimm fairy tales. She says if you think you know Cinderella, Snow White, or Sleeping Beauty, you should think again. For most Americans, these stories feel like Disney inventions, but their true origins are far older, stranger, and more fascinating. And today in the program, she'll take us on a journey 200 years back to discover the original fairy tales collected by the two German brothers, Jakob and Wilhelm Grimm. Dr. Schwabe is a USU professor of German, director of the Brothers Grimm House of North America. She holds a PhD in German studies from University of Florida, an MA in teaching business education from Georgia College and State University, two BAs in international business administration from Germany and the United Kingdom. She's been teaching at USU since 2012. Prior to academia, she worked as an executive assistant for a German manufacturing company and a high school teacher as well. Claudia Schwabe, welcome back to the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tom, for welcoming me back.
That's quite the background. High school teacher and manufacturing. At a certain point, you got into studies. We'll talk about that as we go along. I guess maybe that's a starting point, is your background. We'll get into, and I wasn't able to attend your presentation, but you were kind enough to send over your slide presentation. And the original Grimm tales are Grimm, no, I guess pun intended. sex, violence, mutilation, the whole thing. By the time we get to Disney, it's totally sanitized. We'll ask what that all means. But tell me a little bit about your background. You grew up, I guess, in the hometown of the Brothers Grimm?
Yes, so I was born in Hanau, Germany, and that is about half an hour from Frankfurt am Main. And but I grew up in Mülheim, which is in between Hanau and Frankfurt. And of course, I was exposed to a lot of fairy tale materials early on, and anything from fairy tale theater, puppetry shows. I listened to a bunch of audio tapes with about fairy tales, the Grimm's fairy tales. And I didn't realize until later how much exposure I actually had already in kindergarten with toys and card games and whatnot. So, it seemed almost natural then to follow into the footsteps of the Grimms and to walk the same path.
Tell me about the two brothers here. When did they live? Where? And these are not their original tales, right? They're taking oral traditions.
Exactly. So a lot of people might think that they actually wrote the tales, but that is not true. They collected the tales from mostly, surprisingly, aristocratic women. And that's what most people don't know. They envision them like walking around, traveling around Germany, going from house to house, but that was not the case. They had the source tellers come to their place, and they moved around quite a bit themselves, because they moved from Steinau an der Straße, sorry, in Hesse, Germany. They moved to Kassel, they moved to Göttingen, they moved to Berlin. So they moved around Germany quite a bit, but they always had, when they were in Marburg, they had people come to their place and tell them the fairy stories they grew up with. And so that is one of the misconceptions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They also worked on a dictionary, I think. What would tell us kind of the scope of their work?
That is correct. They are actually the founders of the first German dictionary, and they're really the founding fathers of German studies, if you like. So German philology and German studies. And that is another thing. People, when they think about the Grimms, they reduce them to just the fairy tale research, but they did so much more. And we, as the Brothers Grimm House of North America and the Brothers Grimm Society of North America, we want to spread the word, teach about the Brothers Grimm, their work, their lives, and also enlighten people that Disney did not invent the fairy tales.
So the Grimm brothers revised over time, right? What was the original audience that did they conceive of? By the time it gets to Disney, this is for children. What was their original audience?
Correct. So children were not the original fairy tale audience for the Brothers Grimm. They did it really as an academic, as a scholarly project, and sort of part of the romantic movement. And they tried to capture what they thought of was the authentic essence of the German spirit, of the German soul, so to say. So that was at a time during the Napoleon invasion and the French marching into Germany. And so they really wanted to save what they considered was the German soul or spirit of the people. But you're absolutely right that they did actually a lot of revisions themselves. So not only did they collect the fairy tales, especially Wilhelm Grimm, he revised the fairy tales many times. And I should point out that they published a total of 7 editions throughout their lifetime. So when you compare the early edition from 1812, 1815, it's very different from the last edition of 1857. And Wilhelm very much, though, embellished the tales and expanded on particular tropes. And I have to also point out that the first publication did not sell at all. It was really a flop on the market, so to say. But they needed to make some money, of course. So it wasn't just the academic project. They had to make some money to support their family. So it wasn't until later, after the first publication of the English edition, that they changed their focus of the audience and they actually tailored their tales to children.
So I want to have you pause right here and talk about fairy tales in general. What do fairy tales teach us? What were the Brothers Grimm trying to do? They were trying to demonstrate the soul of what it means to be German, I guess, from these ancient oral traditions. But then that goes on, different purposes for different audiences, I guess. What do fairy tales teach us?
Correct. So later on, when they changed their focus of audience, they considered their tales more to be a pedagogical guide for children. And that was also when, before that, we had complaints of particularly mothers that the tales were too sexualized, too profane, too much violence and so forth. So what they did was they took out a lot of that. They censored it, actually. They censored the sexual innuendos and they changed it so it would be more appealing to children. They also added a lot of religious messages and prayers, and so to say, to make it more palatable for the society at that time. So when you read a fairy tale like Little Red Riding Hood, for instance, you find the mother saying, lecturing basically Little Red Riding Hood, like when you go to your grandmother's house, say hello and goodbye and don't poke your nose in all the corners, don't be too nosy. So all these what you would have considered back in the day to be guidelines for proper behavior for children.
Let's jump into some of this. You have an overview slide here. Wicked mothers, incest, premarital sex, graphic violence, mutilation, cannibalism, child abuse, and anti-Semitism. From there to Disney, it's a big leap. One example, wicked mothers. So the Brothers Grimm changed these from wicked mothers to stepmothers. Was this a backlash from mothers reading these tales, or what happened here?
Yes, exactly. So in all the tales at the beginning, like the famous ones, Hansel and Gretel is a big one, Snow White or the Juniper Tree, it was always biological mothers. And exactly when they shifted the audience, the target audience, they presumably they had complaints by actually mothers to change that. And I have to also emphasize, they held their own mother very in very high regards. So they wanted to preserve this idealized image of the biological mother. So that was in mind of their own mother. So they changed all the biological mothers to stepmothers, which made it then easier for the audience to digest.
So we talk about incest, premarital sex, mutilation, cannibalism. The original oral tales, is that people telling tales to deal with their fears? I could imagine that's one thing that's happening here.
Yes, I mean, there's many reasons why people told fairy tales in the oral tradition. I would say it is really part of our imaginative reservoir. So they communicate values, hopes, fears, desires, and also the aspirations of the societies they emerged from. So I think that is a big point. They give us the what if. They let us imagine what if we were living in a world that was truly just and fair, for instance. So they let us play with these imaginary boundaries. And the reality is we find ourselves in a world that is not just and fair all the time. And when you think about it, we live in a world where we have to deal with parts of the world, at least, with politicians who are crooked or leaders who are oppressing. So there's a lot of suffering in the world. And fairy tales give us a chance to imagine different scenarios. And we have fairy tale heroes and heroines who then come out in the end triumphant. So this is what it's all about. The fairy tales allow us to imagine ourselves triumph against these antagonistic forces. And there is a quote by Chesterton, which goes like, fairy tales not only tell us that dragons exist, but that dragons can be defeated, right?
Well, and in the sanitized versions, we're used to even villains, you know, they might die, but they're not mutilated. It's, you know, et cetera, as in Grimm. For example, all kinds of fur. I wasn't familiar with this one.
Yes. Yeah. So this is a big one. It's somewhat related to Cinderella a little bit, but also donkey skin is the translation. So this is a tale where a king has a beautiful queen, is married to a wonderful, beautiful queen, and she gets sick and she dies. And on her deathbed, she talks to the king and asks him, if you take another wife, make sure that she is just as beautiful as I am. And he promises her. And when the queen has passed away, he tries to find a new wife, but he notices no other woman is as beautiful as his late wife. And then his glance looks at his own daughter at some point, and he gets the idea of actually marrying his own daughter. So there's a prime example of incest case. And then the Grimms, they put in the later editions another sentence that the councilmen try to persuade him not to do that. They say it's sinful. Nothing good can come of it. So that was the Grimms emphasizing then, you should not, you must not do this. But in the tale, the king, he just is very persistent and he wants to marry his own daughter. And so she has no other option left in the end of escaping him.
There's another one called The Girl Without Hands. Pretty brutal, yeah. Very dark.
It's very dark indeed. So the Grimms made sure, though, that the father, the incestuous father, is cast as the devil in the end. So he tries to marry his own daughter, and when she refuses, he cuts off her hands and her breasts and chases her out of the house. So that's a very a brutal one, but in the end, she regains her hands and everything.
Another thing I learned from this, an original version of Rapunzel, it's not the Disney version for sure. It's premarital sex, right? It's a pregnancy.
Absolutely. So we find out in the early Rapunzel version, the prince comes to her tower and visits her every night, and they spend a joyful time together. And then later, she reveals her secret to the witch by saying, how come that my dress is getting tighter and tighter? So, you know, indicating that she is pregnant now. So that was, it was too strong of a reference for the Grimm. So they changed that to just a slip of tongue where the, where Rapunzel says, how come that, that you are so much harder to pull up into the tower than the young prince?
So nowadays we see fairy tales, we, you know, get these books for our kids. But some of these tales, I don't know if we want to, would want to expose our kids to these versions of these tales.
So I can only tell from my own experience. I have two daughters who are eight now, and I read them the Grimm's tales every night, and they love them.
These original versions you're talking about?
So I read the seventh edition, but I also talk about the early editions with them, and I'm specifically referring to any tales that parents consider too violent. Mm. For instance, Hansel and Gretel. So yes, Gretel pushes the witch into the oven, but that is a moment where most children, they cheer and they're happy, you know, that the villain is gone, that the wicked witch is gone. They don't visualize the witch burning in the oven and screaming. So they actually, they think in these very, you know, black and white patterns, the good should be rewarded and the wicked should get punished. And that's just one example. Or when I tell them the tale of Cinderella, we have mutilation in Cinderella. So there are these evil stepsisters, and they're trying, of course, to gain the favor of the prince. And when the prince comes to their house with the famous shoe, they cut off either the heel or the toe. And the mother says, you know, when you're queen, you don't have to walk anymore. So just, you know, do it, get it over with, and the prince will marry you. But then, you know, the turtle doves, they reveal to the prince that there's blood in the shoe, and that is, it's the wrong bride to take home. So again, the children don't get scared about this. They don't visualize it as much as we do.
Mm-hmm. So how are your kids receiving this then? This is just, this is kind of, it's, you know, even the Disney versions have some violence in them. This is ramped up, I guess, but I guess maybe what you're saying is kids can handle this.
Oh yeah. I mean, again, I mean, everyone knows their own kids the best, how sensitive they are. But it's surprising to me. I read it to many, many children. I read the tales, and they usually have no issue with the tales at all. In fact, they ask very different questions usually than what you would expect. And to be honest, let's take the Disney version of Snow White, for instance. So obviously the evil wicked stepmother has to get punished in the end. So let's compare the Disney version with the Grimm version. So you wouldn't visualize the Grimm version, which is, the queen goes to the wedding, and then there's a pair of hot iron slippers brought before her, and she has to step into them and dance until she falls down dead. So maybe you don't want to visualize it, but what Disney chose to visualize, she gets chased by the dwarves, and the dwarves have tools and weapons, and they go after the evil queen. And then it just so happens that she falls off a cliff because the cliff is struck by lightning. But you wonder what would have happened if, you know, she wouldn't have fallen down the cliff and the lightning wouldn't have struck, which is sort of like a godly punishment. Then the dwarves would have lynched her for sure.
The Six Swans, an evil mother-in-law is burned at the stake. There's, you know, some,
yes.
I guess this is on screen, right? There's a little bit of difference, I guess, in visualization. Evil stepmother falls off a cliff. We assume she died after that, but burned at the stake, that's right there.
Yeah, it's a very medieval. So these are very medieval punishments. And the Grimms, they studied law. They had a great sense of justice, and their father was also what you would consider a local judge. So they grew up with a sense of justice, which was very important to them. But With these medieval punishments, it is oftentimes that the villains proclaim their own punishments. So right before it happens, usually they're being asked, how would you punish somebody who did this and this evil deed? And then it's usually the villains themselves. They say, oh, I would roll this person down the hill in a barrel full of nails, naked. And so it's their own doing.
Well, let's take a break. We'll come back with much more with Claudia Schwabe, who is USU professor of German and director of the Brothers Grimm House of North America. We're talking about the Brothers Grimm. She recently gave a presentation called What Disney Didn't Tell You, a tour of the original Grimm fairy tales. Talk more about it following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have with us for the hour USU professor of German, Claudia Schwabe, and she is also director of the Brothers Grimm House of North America. We'll talk about that as we go along. She recently presented an Aggie Talks event called What Disney Didn't Tell You, a tour of the original Grimm fairy tales. Let's talk a little bit about some well-known tales. Rumpelstiltskin, there's some changes or that has been changed a little bit over the years.
Yes, I love the figure of Rumpelstiltskin. In fact, I have just written a book chapter and submitted it to a German press. I gave a presentation last summer. So Rumpelstiltskin is very interesting. And what I found is that the white supremacists, the far right, but also Jewish scholars and writers have interpreted this figure to be a Jew, basically. They misinterpret the figure and say this figure exhibits some Jewish traits, when in fact Rumpelstiltskin has nothing whatsoever to do with Jewishness or being Jewish. But I found it interesting that in online chat rooms and platforms of the extreme right, as well as some Jewish writers, this figure has been completely misinterpreted. So that's what I wrote about in my chapter.
So Hansel and Gretel, this is under your presentation under cannibalism. This, you know, again, very, very dark. These are coming from old oral traditions. So the witch builds a house of bread and cake to lure the children, as we know, so she can cook and eat them, right?
Yes, absolutely. So Hansel and Gretel goes back to a very sad reality of actual famine in the country. And what you find with fairy tales usually is that they resemble everyday life or real life, either now or as it was in history. But only in hindsight, you can find parallels. So it would be wrong to say this particular fairy tale character is this particular princess who once lived or king who once lived. They're still completely fictional. We have to keep that in mind. But there are these similarities, of course, in these the coloring that have to do with real life, and that's maybe also why we're so drawn to it. I'm being asked the question over and over, why are we so drawn to fairy tales, and why do we need these stories? And we need them, I would argue, to as a protection or shelter against the real, because there's so many parallels still that apply to the present day. So yes, Hansel and Gretel is completely fictional, but cannibalism, you know, it happened. Yeah, that's a fact.
You, in your presentation, you talk about Einstein. Yes. Could you tell me that story? That was fascinating to me.
I love this story. So it's a story about a mother and her young boy meeting Albert Einstein, and the mother goes to him and asks him, what should my son read to become as intelligent as you are? And Albert Einstein replies, fairy tales. And the woman says, okay, and after that, what should he read? And Albert Einstein repeats, more fairy tales. And it's a wonderful little story. And I found out recently that the boy in the story was actually Jack Zibes, one of the top fairy tale experts in North America. So I love this story.
So Einstein, I guess, I don't know what was going on there. I don't know if Zipes goes on to say what was in Einstein's mind. I could imagine, if you want to be a physicist, you need to have a vivid imagination and nurture that.
Yes, absolutely. So I think imagination is everything. It's at the heart of everything. And these stories, they tell us, they're really like little gold nuggets that we approach, and they encapsulate this elder wisdom, I would say. And it is up to us as humans to try to decipher these stories. But that's why they resonate with us so much. They carry something that we like to decipher and bring to the light. So I think that's why fairy tales matter and why the imagination matters.
Now, you note that there's some anti-Semitism in some of these tales. I guess maybe at the time of the Brothers Grimm, that might not have been controversial. And nowadays, of course, thankfully it is. Tell me about this.
Yes. So it is true. I mean, in the 200 fairy tales, there are these three stories that are anti-Semitic. And we have to talk about it. We should talk about it. But I would argue it's not that the Grimms were anti-Semitic. They were friends with Jews, and they were not anti-Semitic. It's just that they collected the tales that were told to them. And so these were just, I mean, three of the 200 and more tales that they were told to, and they decided to just integrate these tales into their collection. Now, it was problematic during the Third Reich, during the Nazi time, because they used these, they adopted the Grimm's tales for propaganda purposes. But we have to differentiate, and we have to nuance. It was a different time during Romanticism, and it was a time of anti-Judaism at that time. So, that's what I can say about that.
There are a couple, two or three tales you have in your presentation that I had not been familiar with at all. One is just haunting. It's called The Willful Child. Tell me this one.
Yeah, The Willful Child. It's one of the shortest stories, in fact. And I like to read it to my students to show them how differently fairy tales, how different forms they can take, and that not all fairy tales are like they lived happily ever after. So in this tale, this is about a stubborn child, and a stubborn child or willful child that does not listen to the parents. And so, the child dies and sticks out a little arm is popping out of the grave every time. And so the mother has to chastise the child with a switch or a rod and has to spank the child so it finally finds peace in the grave. And again, this kind of goes back to the Grimms thinking of their tales as a pedagogical or instructional manual, to teach children a lesson, basically. Be respectful to your parents and listen to your parents. That's part of it.
Yeah, I guess that even after death, you learn the lesson, right? The Fisherman and His Wife. Tell me, I had not heard of this one.
Oh, yeah. So this is one of my favorite fairy tales. And I love it also because it shows us what the influence of nature also. So this is about a fisherman and his wife, and they're living in a little shack. And the fisherman goes out and catches a flounder one day. And of course, the flounder can speak, and it's a magical fish. And the flounder says, "If you let me go, I will fulfill you a wish." And the fisherman is very humble. He has really no wishes. He just lets the fish go. And then he goes back to his wife, and the wife says, "Well, you should have asked for a bigger house." And so she sends him back, and he calls upon the fish, and it's almost like a magical incantation. And the fish asks, "So what does your wife want?" And he says, "Oh, she wants to live in a bigger house, more beautiful house." So, and he goes back, and it magically happens. And this goes on for quite some time. She then wants to live in a palace, and then she wants to be queen, and then she wants to be empress, and so forth. So she's asking for more and more, and she becomes more and more greedy, and she's never satisfied. And it happens in shorter time every time. So and every time he goes back to the fish, the sea becomes more and more rough and darker, and then the weather turns stormy. And in the end, it all culminates in the fact that the wife asks first to be like the Pope, and then she asks to be like God. And at that point, he returns home and finds her back in the old shack.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot of lessons there. Yeah, for sure.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah.
Tell me about the star money. Again, I'm not familiar with this one.
Yes, again, one of my favorite fairy tales is, again, one of the shortest in the story. And this is about a little girl who is orphaned and who really has nothing, no parents. And she just has a piece of bread in her hand and the clothes she's wearing. And she trusts in God and goes out into the world. And she just trusts that everything will be okay. And then at every corner she meets a child who is hungry or cold, or an old man who asks for something to eat. And so she just keeps on giving. She gives him the whole piece of bread she has, and she says, "God bless," and continues. And every child she gives some of her clothing, either her hat or her jacket and so forth. And then as it gets dark, there's another child, and she gives her last shirt, and she stands basically naked in the forest, and it's dark, and she looks up to the sky, and the stars start raining down on her, and they become these hard gold coins and shower her in gold, and she wears a dress of gold linen, and so she is rewarded for her selflessness for the rest of her life.
Yeah, that's a positive lesson.
Yes.
There. Yes. Yeah. Wonderful. Let's take another break. I want to come back and talk about some of your other work and kind of bring this forward. You and I had a conversation a couple of years ago on craving supernatural creatures. This kind of brings it. The subtitle is German Fairy Tale Figures in American Pop Culture. We'll talk about some upcoming works of yours, and I want to get to talking about the Brothers Grimm House. It's a nice project here at USU that you've done. We're talking with Claudia Schwabe. She is a professor of German and director of the Brothers Grimm House, and we're talking about what Disney didn't tell you, a tour of original Grimm fairy tales. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. USU professor of German Claudia Schwabe recently presented an Aggie Talks event called What Disney Didn't Tell You, a tour of the original Grimm fairy tales. We're talking about that on the program today. Dr. Schwabe is also director of the Brothers Grimm House. I'm just reading. I'm seeing a caption to a photo here, Dr. Schwabe. Logan High School students perform a scene from Dornröschen during the opening of the Brothers Grimm House at Utah State University. I've never heard of this one either. They're depicting this tale.
Yeah. So the title of the play is a word play on the German title Dornröschen, which is Sleeping Beauty, And we had this wonderful kickoff event in March of the Brothers Grimm House of North America. And we were very happy and thankful for the high school students to come in. And the German teacher, Mike Mudrow, practicing a wonderful, wonderful play. And yeah, they performed the play. And we had a class of first graders from Edith Bowen Laboratory School in the audience. And it was just so fun to see the interaction and the response, the reaction of the children to the play, which was, Sleeping Beauty with a twist, I would say.
Okay.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. So tell us about Brothers Grimm House of North America. Where is this? What is it? What can people see when they go? This is right here in Logan, right?
Yeah. So a little bit background. In 2021, I co-founded a nonprofit organization called the Brothers Grimm Society of North America. You can look that up online. And we, of course, our mission is to promote the life and work and the legacy of the Brothers Grimm. And we always needed a physical location. So last year, I sat down with my department head, and I had the idea of bringing the Brothers Grimm House to Utah State University. And one of the reasons is that we have in our library at USU one of the biggest Little Red Riding Hood collections in North America. And it's not just Little Red Riding Hood, it's also Hansel and Gretel and Snow White and some other fairy tales. So what better location than to bring the Brothers Grimm House here to Utah State? And I hope we will grow. This is really a space for the students. I would like to offer the students the opportunity to do internships with us. And anyone who is interested in fairy tales and the Brothers Grimm to make use of the house, our resources. We have received a lot of donations in the past. Financial donation and books, and we're still collecting. So this is a shout out to everyone who wants to donate. And it started with a small donation, but a wonderful donation of a spinning wheel. We're in the Mehdi Harafi Global Teaching and Learning Center. So that's our location. And we hope to do a lot of outreach events and also on campus, of course. Mm-hmm.
And if you're not familiar with that center, it's very near Old Main on the kind of on kitty corners of the quad on the USU campus. I want to have you talk a little bit about, we've had a full conversation on this book. You can find that at upr.org. I'll just read this little synopsis of the book. Craving Supernatural Creatures is the book. German fairy tale figures in American pop culture. So the book analyzes supernatural creatures in order to demonstrate how German fairy tales, these originals, treat difference, alterity, and otherness with terror, distance, and negativity, whereas contemporary North American popular culture adaptations navigate diversity by humanizing and redeeming such figures. So this kind of brings this discussion up to how it arrived in North America, how it arrived at such outlets as Disney.
Yes, so this is a book I published a while back, and it's still ongoing. I mean, all you have to do is look at the most recent Disney retellings and Disney reimaginations. And it's this whole idea, something I noticed, that all the villains from the Grimm's fairy tales, how Disney changes these characters and fleshes out their background and sort of makes them more sympathetic to us as viewers or audience. And a good example is Maleficent, for instance, played by Angelina Jolie in the movies. So that's just one example where the villain appears actually more of a victim when we know her backstory. So for anyone who's familiar with it, she has wings in this adaptation, and there is a scene where she gets her wings cut off, which is a metaphorical rape. So which then explains her background and why she became villainous in the first place. This is a trend I noticed with many Disney adaptations. We always now want to find out more about the villains, and we're actually rooting for them. And there's a lot of merchandising, a lot of toys that are actually just, you know, the villains, and we're rooting for the villains. And there's this other show, Disney, called The Descendants, which follows the same pattern, basically.
What's going on here, do you think, by starting to root for the villains, looking for the backstory in the villains? What does that say about us and our culture, do you think?
Exactly. So, I mean, in the Grimm tales, we follow a very black and white silhouette style pattern, which is very typical for fairy tales. But now we like to look at it more, make it more complex. So we look at it from fresh angles. I mean, if we would always look at it from the same angle, it would get boring right away. So it's part of the fairy tale's fascination that it can always change and shift. And I like to think of it as sort of a kaleidoscopic magic that fairy tales keep on changing. And every time you tilt it a little bit. So now our focus is on the villains and their rehabilitation, and also making villains funny that weren't funny before. So to somewhat infantilize the villains, to make them comedic. And Shrek is a wonderful example of that, right? The scary ogre who usually, gobbles up people. And now we like to laugh about the villains. And that, of course, takes a little bit of the fear away that you might have had originally for that character, whether it's the evil wolf in the story of Little Red Riding Hood, the big bad wolf, or the wicked witch. So by making it comedic or desirable, it takes away that component of fear.
Your most recent project, The Routledge Companion to Fairy Tales, you're one of the editors here. What do you hope to accomplish with this one?
So I'm very proud of this one. I did this together with my colleague, Krista Jones, who is a French professor. And we brought together 37 scholars, folklore scholars, fairy tale scholars, from 35 different places and universities and countries. We have 35 different chapters. So I would say this is the biggest compilation of knowledge, expert knowledge on fairy tales and folklore. And every chapter is very unique in its approach. And I'm just very proud that it's out there now. And it just enlightens people more about the fairy tale and how versatile it is. And that fairy tales are wonderful to induce wonder in people. And I think that's one of the key elements, because when we read fairy tales, we are to wonder about the workings of the universe, where anything can happen at any time and there's no explanation necessary. So I hope people will enjoy it.
So you've studied, of course, this book we referenced, the Grimm fairy tales as they traveled to North America. Have the Grimm fairy tales traveled to other cultures, Asia, for example, other places?
Yeah, I mean, after the Bible, it's the Grimm's fairy tales, the children's and household tales of the Brothers Grimm that are the most read book worldwide after the Bible. So they have been traveling to all parts of the world, and they have been very popular, for instance, in Japan and Asian countries in particular. But we're at a moment now in fairy tale scholarship where we actually like to also shift the focus away from Europe, away from the Grimms, and what some scholars call to decolonize the fairy tales, to look at other fairy tale traditions from other countries. So if you look into fairy tale scholarship, so that's a big shift that's happening right now.
I imagine there are general themes. If you go to any nation and look at their kind of original fairy tales, probably be some similar themes, but also differences.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's different... It's wonderful how versatile the fairy tale is, and you can approach it from so many angles. And so eco-criticism is a big one right now, that we look more at nature in the fairy tales and how the protagonists interact with nature. And then also disability studies, race studies, LGBTQ studies. You can approach it from so many different angles. What I love about the topic to begin with. So go out and look at, you know, African fairy tales, South American fairy tales, and how they differ, and what and you again, you can take your pick. It's like a smorgasbord of topics that you can pick and tie to the fairy tale.
Interesting. You list in this presentation some upcoming works. This one struck me. Why So Wicked? Representations of Stepmothers in Popular German and Algerian Folktales.
Yes.
I'm not familiar with any Algerian folktales. I guess Stepmothers feature?
Yeah, so this is a book chapter I did again together with my colleague Krista Jones, and she is the expert in the Algerian fairy tales. And usually when we do projects together, I kind of tend to write about the Grimm's tales and or the American reimaginations, retellings, and she has the expertise in that department there. So I like to collaborate. It helps to bring different perspectives. And I'm happy to say this was, I think, our third collaboration together. So I'm very happy and thankful that we can do that at Utah State University and in our department, that we can reach out to different colleagues and from different disciplines and collaborate.
Now, I guess there's a natural fear there, right? A stepmother coming in. The fear of maybe the child is that things are going to be different, or they're going to be different bad or different good, right?
Yeah. I mean, there is these stepmother tales in the Grimm's collection. For example, the juniper tree is a big one that comes to mind. And I mean, very in the Grimm's tales, very gruesome. We have a stepmother here who decapitates her stepson in a very insinuous manner. She tells him to go and take a look and get an apple out of a box. And as he bends over the box, she just slaps down the lid of the box. And then she blames it on her own daughter. And not enough with that, she also then chops up her stepson and cooks him into a stew and feeds the stew to her husband. So, I mean, these stepmother tales stand out. They're very gruesome, very horrible. And in that tale, she gets punished by a bird dropping a millstone on her. And the bird is, in fact, a transformation of her stepson. So all these tales are also, I should emphasize, very much about transformation. And this particular tale is about resurrection.
Just about a minute left. I wonder what your big takeaway is from this discussion, especially this, a tour of the original Grimm fairy tales. What do you want people to take away?
Well, these tales continue to fascinate. And again, I think one of the key things about the fairy tales is this elder wisdom, or the golden nugget of wisdom. And as my colleague Maria Tatar said, we are meaning makers. So we're not just Homo sapiens, but Homo significans. And we like to make meaning of these tales. And whenever I approach a Grimm's tale, I learn something new. I look at it from a slightly different angle, and they continue to fascinate. And I take out meaning that applies to me. And I think we can all take something away from these stories that are meaningful to us at a very personal level.
We've been talking with Claudia Schwabe. She's a professor of German and director of the Brothers Grimm House. Thank you so much. Fascinating discussion. Appreciate it.
You're so welcome, Tom.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.